organized his life to suit himself, and the habit was hard to break.
"Can't," he said. "Sorry. I'm on a job until 3.
The lie convincingly told, she took it reasonably well. They agreed to meet at the bistro on Sunday evening, as previously planned, which meant that he would be able to watch Arsenal-Liverpool in peace. After he had hung up, he thought again of Robin, alone in the flat she shared with Matthew. Reaching for a cigarette, he turned on the TV and sank back onto his pillows in the dark. Robin was having a strange weekend. Determined not to sink into moroseness just because she was alone and Strike had gone off to Ellen's. Where had that thought come from? Of course he had gone. After all, it was the weekend, and it was no business of hers where he chose to spend it. She had spent hours on her laptop, doggedly pursuing one old line of inquiry and one new. Late on Saturday night, she made an online discovery that caused her to jog 3 victory laps of the tiny sitting room and almost phone Strike to tell him. It took several minutes, with her heart thumping and her breath coming fast, to calm down and to tell herself that the news would keep until Monday. It would be much more satisfying to tell him in person. Knowing that Robin was alone, her mother called her twice over the weekend, both times pressing for a date when she could come down to London.
"I don't know, Mum. Not just now," sighed Robin on Sunday morning.
She was sitting in her pyjamas on the sofa, laptop open in front of her again, trying to hold an online conversation with a member of the BIID community who called themselves Devotee. She had only picked up her mother's call because she was afraid ignoring it might result in an unannounced visit.
"Devotee, where do you want to be cut?"
"Trans hopeful. Mid-thigh."
"Devotee, both legs?"
"What about tomorrow?" asked Linda.
"No,"
said Robin at once. Like Strike, she lied with fluent conviction.
"I'm midway through a job. The following week's better."
"Trans hopeful.
Yes, both.
Do you know anyone who's done it?"
"Devotee. Can't share that on MSJ board. Where you live?"
"I haven't seen him," said Linda. "Robin, are you typing?"
"No,"
Robin lied again, her fingers suspended over the keyboard.
"Who haven't you seen?"
"Matthew, of course."
"Oh, well, no. I didn't think he'd come calling this weekend."
She tried typing more quietly.
"Trans hopeful. London. Devotee. Me too. Got a pick."
"Did you go to Mr. Cunliffe's birthday party?" she asked, trying to drown out the sound of the laptop keys.
"Of course we didn't," said Linda.
"Well, let me know what day's best week after next, and I'll book my ticket. It's Easter, it'll be busy." Robin agreed, returned Linda's affectionate goodbye, and directed her full attention to Devotee. Unfortunately, after Robin had refused to give him or her, she was almost positive that he was male, a picture, Devotee lost interest in their back and forth on the notice boards and went quiet. She had expected Matthew to return from his father's on Sunday evening, but he did not. When she checked the calendar in the kitchen at 8, she realized that he had always intended to take Monday off. Presumably she had agreed to this back when the weekend had been planned and told Matthew that she would ask Strike for a day's holiday too. It was lucky that they had split up, really, she told herself bracingly. She had dodged one more row about her working hours. However, she cried later, alone in the bedroom that was thick with relics of their shared past, the fluffy elephant he had given her on their first Valentine's Day together. He had not been so suave in those days. She could remember him turning red as he had produced it, and the jewellery box he had given her for her 21st. Then there were all the photographs showing them beaming during holidays in Greece and Spain, and dressed up at Matthew's sister's wedding. The biggest picture of the lot showed them arm in arm on Matthew's graduation day. He was in his academic gown, and Robin stood beside him in a summer dress, beaming, as she celebrated an achievement of which she had been robbed by a man in a gorilla mask.
Chapter 31. Nighttime flowers, evening roses. Bless this garden that never closes. Blue Oyster Cult, Tenderloin.
Robin's mood was buoyed next day by the glorious spring morning that greeted her outside her front door. She did not forget to remain aware of her surroundings as she travelled by tube towards Tottenham Court Road, but saw no sign of any large man in a beanie hat. What leapt to the eye on her morning commute was the mounting journalistic excitement about the royal wedding. Kate Middleton seemed to be on the front of virtually every newspaper held by her fellow travellers. It made Robin hyper-aware all over again of that naked, sensitive place on her third finger where an engagement ring had sat for a year. However, excited as she was about sharing the results of her solo investigative work with Strike, Robin refused to be downcast. She had just left Tottenham Court Road Station when she heard a man shout her name. For a split second, she feared an ambush by Matthew. Then Strike appeared, forging a path through the crowd, backpack on his shoulder. Robin deduced that he had spent the night with Ellen.
"Morning. Good weekend?" he asked.
Then, before she could answer, "Sorry, no. Crap weekend, obviously." "Bits of it were all right," said Robin, as they wended their way through the usual obstacle course of barriers and holes in the road.
"What have you got?"
Strike asked loudly over the interminable drills.
"Sorry?"
she shouted.
"What have you found out? How do you know I found anything out?" "You got that look," he said. "The look you get when you're dying to tell me something."
She grinned.
"I need a computer to show you."
They turned the corner into Denmark Street. A man dressed all in black stood outside their office door, holding a gigantic bunch of red roses.
"Oh, for God's sake," breathed Robin.
A spasm of fear receded. Her mind had momentarily edited out the armful of blooms and seen only the man in black. But it wasn't the courier, of course. This, she saw as they approached him, was a youth with long hair, an Interflora delivery man wearing no helmet. Strike doubted the boy had ever handed over 50 red roses to a less enthusiastic recipient. "His father's put him up to this," Robin said darkly, as Strike held open the door for her, and she pushed her way inside, being none too gentle with the quivering floral display. "All women love roses," he'll have said. "That's all it takes, a bunch of bloody flowers." Strike followed her up the metal staircase, amused but careful not to show it. He unlocked the office door, and Robin crossed to her desk and dropped the roses unceremoniously onto it, where they quivered in their beribboned polythene bag of greenish water. There was a card. She did not want to open it in front of Strike.
"Well,"
he asked, hanging his backpack on the peg beside the door,
"what have you found out?"
Before Robin could say a word, there was a rap on the door. Wardle's shape was easily recognizable through the frosted glass, his wavy hair, his leather jacket.
"I was in the area. Not too early, is it? Bloke downstairs let me in."
Wardle's eyes travelled immediately to the roses on Robin's desk.
"Birthday?"
"No," she said shortly. "Do either of you want coffee?"
"I'll do it," said Strike, moving over to the kettle and still speaking to Robin. "Wardle's got some stuff to show us."
Robin's spirit sank. Was the policeman about to preempt her? Why hadn't she called Strike on Saturday night when she'd found it? Wardle sat down on the mock-leather sofa that always emitted loud farting noises when anyone over a certain weight sat on it. Clearly startled, the policeman repositioned himself gingerly and opened a folder. It turns out Kelsey was posting on a website for other people who wanted to get limbs taken off, Wardle told Robin. Robin sat down in her usual seat behind her desk. The roses impeded her view of the policeman. She picked them up impatiently and deposited them on the floor beside her. "She mentioned Strike," Wardle went on. "Asked if anyone else knew anything about him." "Was she using the name Nowhere to Turn?" asked Robin, trying to keep her voice casual. Wardle looked up, astonished, and Strike turned, a coffee spoon suspended in mid-air.
"Yeah, she was," said the policeman, staring. "How the hell did you know that?"
"I found that message board last weekend," said Robin. "I thought Nowhere to Turn might be the girl who wrote the letter."
"Christ," said Wardle, looking from Robin to Strike. "We should offer her a job." "She's got a job," said Strike. "Go on, Kelsey was posting."
"Yeah, well, she ended up exchanging email addresses with these two. Nothing particularly helpful, but we're looking to establish whether they actually met her, you know, in real life," said Wardle. Strange, thought Strike, how that phrase, so prevalent in childhood to differentiate between the fantasy world of play and the dull adult world of fact, had now come to signify the life that a person had outside the internet. He handed Wardle and Robin their coffees, then went through to his inner office to fetch a chair, preferring not to share the farting sofa with Wardle. When he returned, Wardle was showing Robin printed screenshots of the Facebook pages of two people. She examined each of them carefully, then passed them on to Strike. One was a thick-set young woman with a round, pale face, bobbed black hair, and glasses. The other was a light-haired man in his 20s, with lopsided eyes. "She blogs about being transabled, whatever the fuck that is, and he's all over message boards, asking for help in hacking bits off himself. Both of them have got serious issues, if you ask me. Recognize either of them?" Strike shook his head, as did Robin. Wardle sighed and took the pictures back. "Long shot."
"What about other men she's been knocking around with? Any boys or lecturers at college?" asked Strike, thinking of the questions that had occurred to him on Sunday.
"Well, the sister says Kelsey claimed to have a mysterious boyfriend they were never allowed to meet. Hazel doesn't believe he existed. We've spoken to a couple of Kelsey's college friends, and none of them ever saw a boyfriend, but we're following it up."
"Speaking of Hazel," Wardle went on, picking up his coffee and drinking some before continuing, "I've said I'll pass on a message. She'd like to meet you."
"Me?" said Strike, surprised. "Why?"
"I don't know," said Wardle. "I think she wants to justify herself to everyone. She's in a real state."
"Justify herself?"
"She's guilt-ridden because she treated the leg thing as weird and attention-seeking, and feels that's why Kelsey went looking for someone else to help her with it. She understands I never wrote back, that I never had actual contact with her."
"Yeah, yeah, I've explained that to her.
She still wants to talk to you."
"I don't know," said Wardle slightly impatiently.
"You got sent her sister's leg. You know what people are like when they're in shock."
"Plus, it's you, isn't it?"
said Wardle, with a faint edge in his voice. "She probably thinks the boy Wonder will solve it while the police are blundering." Robin and Strike avoided looking at each other, and Wardle added grudgingly, "We could have handled Hazel better. Our guys interrogated her partner a bit more aggressively than she liked. It put her on the defensive. She might like the idea of having you on the books, the detective who's already saved one poor innocent from the nick." Strike decided to ignore the defensive undertone. "Obviously, we had to question the bloke who was living with her," Wardle added for Robin's benefit. "That's routine."
"Yes," said Robin. "Of course."
"No other man in her life, except the sister's partner and this alleged boyfriend?" asked Strike.
"She was seeing a male counsellor, a skinny black guy in his 50s, who was visiting family in Bristol on the weekend she died. And there's a church youth group leader called Darryl," said Wardle. "Fat guy in dungarees. He cried his eyes out all through the interview. He was present and correct at the church on the Sunday. Nothing checkable otherwise, but I can't see him wielding a cleaver. That's everyone we know about. Her course is nearly all girls."
"No boys in the church youth group?"
"They're nearly all girls as well. Oldest boy's 14.
"How would the police feel about me seeing Hazel?" Strike asked.
"We can't stop you," Wardle said, shrugging. "I'm for it, on the understanding that you'll pass on anything useful, but I doubt there's anything else there. We've interviewed everyone, we've been through Kelsey's room, we've got a laptop, and personally I bet none of the people we've talked to knew anything.
They all thought she was off on a college placement. After thanks for the coffee and a particularly warm smile for Robin, which was barely returned, Wardle left.
Not a word about Brockbank, Lang or Whittaker, Strike grumbled, as Wardle's clanging footsteps faded from earshot. And you never told me you'd been ferreting around on the net, he added to Robin.
I had no proof she was the girl who'd written the letter, said Robin. But I did think Kelsey might have gone online looking for help.
Strike heaved himself to his feet, took her mug from her desk, and was heading for the door when Robin said indignantly, Aren't you interested in what I was going to tell you? He turned, surprised.
That wasn't it?
No.
Well?
I think I found Donald Lang.
Strike said nothing at all, but stood looking blank, a mug in each hand.
You've... what? How?
Robin turned on her computer, beckoned Strike over, and began typing. He moved around to look over her shoulder. First, she said, I had to find out how to spell psoriatic arthritis. Then, look at this. She had brought up a Just Giving charity page. A man glared out of the small picture at the top.
Bloody hell, that's him,
said Strike, so loudly that Robin jumped. He set the mugs down and dragged his chair around the desk to look at the monitor. In doing so, he knocked over Robin's roses.
Shit, sorry,
I don't care, said Robin. Sit here, I'll clean them up. She moved out of the way, and Strike took her place on the swivel chair. It was a small photograph, which Strike enlarged by clicking on it. The Scot was standing on what seemed to be a cramped balcony, with a balustrade of thick greenish glass, unsmiling, with a crutch under his right arm. The short, bristly hair still grew low on his forehead, but it seemed to have darkened over the years, no longer red as a fox's pelt. Clean-shaven, his skin looked pockmarked. He was less swollen in the face than he had been in Lorraine's picture, but he had put on weight since the days when he had been muscled like a marble atlas and had bitten Strike on the face in the boxing ring. He was wearing a yellow T-shirt, and on his right forearm was the rose tattoo, which had undergone a modification. A dagger now ran through it, and drops of blood fell out of the flower towards the wrist. Behind Lang on his balcony was what looked like a blurry, jagged pattern of windows in black and silver. He had used his real name. Donald Lang Charity Appeal. I am a British veteran now suffering from psoriatic arthritis. I am raising money for arthritis research. Please give what you can. The page had been created 3 months previously. He had raised 0% of the £1,000 he was hoping to meet.
No rubbish about doing anything for the money, Strike noted. Just gimme.
Not give me, Robin corrected him from the floor, where she was mopping up spilled flower water with bits of kitchen roll. He's giving it to the charity.
So he says.
Strike was squinting at the jagged pattern behind Lang on the balcony.
Does that remind you of anything? Those windows behind him.
I thought of the gherkin at first, said Robin, throwing the sodden towels in the bin and getting to her feet. But the pattern's different.
Nothing about where he's living, said Strike,
clicking everywhere he could on the page to see what further information he might uncover.
Just Giving must have his details somewhere.
You somehow never expect evil people to get ill, said Robin. She checked her watch. I'm supposed to be on platinum in 15. I better get going.
Yeah, said Strike,
still staring at Lang's picture.
Keep in touch, and, oh yeah, I need you to do something.
He pulled his mobile out of his pocket.
Brockbank.
So you do still think it might be him, Robin said, pausing in the act of putting on her jacket.
Maybe. I want you to call him. Keep the Venetia Hall personal injury lawyer thing going.
Oh, okay, she said, pulling out her own mobile and keying in the number that he had shown her. But beneath her matter-of-fact manner,
she was quietly elated. Venetia had been her own idea, her creation, and now Strike was turning the whole line of inquiry over to her. She was halfway up Denmark Street in the sunshine, before Robin remembered that there had been a card with the now battered roses, and that she had left it behind, unread. Chapter 32. What's that in the corner? It's too dark to see. Blue Oyster Cult, after dark. Surrounded all day long by the sounds of traffic and loud voices, Robin did not have a good opportunity to call Noel Brockbank until 5 o'clock that afternoon. Having seen Platinum to work as usual, she turned into the Japanese restaurant beside the lap dancing club and took her green tea to a quiet corner table. There she waited for 5 minutes to satisfy herself that any background noises Brockbank might hear could plausibly belong to a busy office situated on a main road, and keyed in the number, her heart hammering. It was still in service. Robin listened to it ringing for 20 seconds, and then, just when she had guessed that nobody was going to pick up, somebody did. Very heavy breathing roared down the line. Robin sat still, the mobile tight against her ear. Then she jumped as a shrill toddler's voice said, "Hello?"
"Hello?"
said Robin cautiously. In the background, a woman's muffled voice said, "What have you got, Sahara?" A scraping noise, and then, much louder, "That's Knowles. He's been look—" The line went dead. Robin lowered the phone slowly, her heart still racing. She could almost see the sticky little finger that had accidentally cut the call. The phone began to vibrate in her hand, Brockbank's number calling back. She took a steadying breath and answered, "Hello, Venetia Hall." "What?" said a woman's voice. "Venetia Hall, Hardacre and Hall," said Robin. "What?" said the woman again. "Did you just call this number?" She had a London accent. Robin's mouth was dry. "Yes, I did," said Robin as Venetia. "I'm looking for Mr. Noel Brockbank."
"Why?"
After an almost imperceptible pause, Robin said, "Could I ask who I'm speaking to, please?"
"Why?"
The woman was sounding increasingly belligerent.
"Who are you?"
"My name's Venetia Hall," said Robin, "and I'm a lawyer specializing in personal injury compensation." A couple sat down in front of her and began to talk loudly in Italian.
"What?"
said the woman on the end of the line again. Inwardly cursing her neighbors, Robin raised her voice and gave the same story that she had told Holly back in Barrow.
"Money for him?"
said the unknown woman, with a degree less animosity.
"Yes, if his case is successful," said Robin. "Can I ask, how'd you find out about him?"
"We came across Mr. Brockbank's records while we were researching other—"
"How much money?"
"That depends." Robin took a deep breath.
"Where is Mr. Brockbank?"
"At work."
"Can I ask where? I'll get him to call you. This number, yeah?"
"Yes, please," said Robin. "I'll be here in the office tomorrow from 9.
Then, what was your name?"
Robin spelled Venetia for her.
"Yeah, all right then. I'll get him to call. Bye then."
Robin rang Strike to tell him what had happened as she walked towards the tube, but his number was engaged. Her spirits ebbed as she descended into the underground. Matthew would be at home by now. It felt as though it had been a long time since she had seen her ex-fiancé, and she dreaded their reunion. Her mood sank still further as she travelled home, wishing she had a valid reason to stay away, but grudgingly obedient to her promise to Strike that she would not stay out after dark. 40 minutes later, she arrived at West Ealing Station. Walking towards the flat with dread in her heart, her second attempt to call Strike went through.
"Bloody good work,"
he said, when she told him that she had successfully contacted Brockbank's phone.
"You say this woman had a London accent?"
"I think so," said Robin, feeling that Strike was missing a more important point, "and a small daughter by the sounds of it."
Yeah, expect that's why Brockbank's there.
She had expected him to show more concern for a child in close proximity with a man he knew to be a child rapist, but no. He briskly changed the subject.
I've just been on the phone to Hazel Furley.
Who?
Kelsey's sister, remember? Who wants to meet me. I'm going to see her on Saturday.
Oh, said Robin.
Can't do it before then. Mad Dad's back from Chicago, just as well. Two times won't support us forever.
Robin did not respond. She was still thinking about the toddler who had answered the phone. Strike's reaction to that news had disappointed her.
Are you all right? Asked Strike.
Yes, said Robin. She had reached the end of Hastings Road. Well, I'll see you tomorrow, she said. He agreed to it and hung up. Feeling unexpectedly worse for having spoken to Strike, she headed with some trepidation towards her front door. She need not have worried. The Matthew who had returned from Massam was no longer the man who begged Robin hourly to talk to him. He slept on the sofa. Over the next 3 days they moved carefully around each other, Robin with cool politeness, he with an air of ostentatious devotion that tipped at times into parody. He hurried to wash up cups as soon as she had finished drinking from them, and on Thursday morning asked her respectfully how work was going.
Oh, please, was Robin's only response, as she strode past him to the front door.
His family, she guessed, had told him to back off to give her time. They had not yet discussed how they were going to tell everyone else that the wedding was off. Matthew clearly did not wish to have that discussion. Day to day, Robin stopped short of initiating the conversation. Sometimes she asked herself whether this cowardice revealed her own secret desire to put her ring back on. At others, she was sure that her reluctance sprang from exhaustion, disinclination for what she knew would be the worst and most painful confrontation yet, and a need to marshal her forces before the final break. Little though she had encouraged her mother's forthcoming visit, Robin was subconsciously hoping to draw enough strength and comfort from Linda to do what had to be done. The roses on her desk shriveled slowly. Nobody had bothered to put them in fresh water, so they died quietly in the wrappings in which they had arrived. But Robin was not there to throw them out, and Strike, who visited the office infrequently to fetch things, felt it would be out of place for him to dispose of them, or of the still unopened card. After the previous week of regular contact, Robin and Strike had resumed a work pattern that meant they rarely saw each other, taking it in turns to follow Platinum and Mad Dad, who would return from America and immediately resume the stalking of his young sons. On Thursday afternoon, they discussed by phone the question of whether Robin should try Noel Brockbank again, because he had still not called her back. After consideration, Strike told her that Venetia Hall, busy lawyer, would have other fish to fry.
If he hasn't contacted you by tomorrow, you can try again. That'll be a full working week. Of course, his lady friend might have lost the number.
When Strike had hung up, Robin resumed her wanderings in Edge Street in Kensington, which was where Mad Dad's family lived. The location did nothing to lift Robin's spirits. She had begun looking online for somewhere else to live, but the places she would be able to afford on the salary Strike paid her were even worse than she had feared, single rooms in shared houses the best she could expect. The beautiful Victorian Mews houses that surrounded her, with glossy front doors, leafy climbing plants, window boxes and bright sash windows, spoke of the comfortable, prosperous existence to which Matthew had aspired back in the days that Robin seemed ready to embrace a more lucrative career. She had told him all along that she did not care about money, or at least not as much as he did, and that remained true. But it would be a strange human being, she thought, who could linger among these pretty, quiet houses and not compare them to the other's detriment, with small room in strictly vegan household, mobile phone tolerated if used in bedroom, that was just within her price range, or the cupboard-sized room in Hackney in friendly and respectful household, ready to
take you on board.
Her mobile rang again. She tugged the phone out of her jacket pocket, expecting Strike, and her stomach turned over. Brockbank. Taking a deep breath, she answered. Venetia Hall.
You the lawyer?
She did not know what she had expected him to sound like. He had taken monstrous form in her mind, this rapist of children, the long-jawed thug with his broken bottle, and what Strike believed to be fake amnesia. His voice was deep, and his accent, though by no means as thick as his twin's, remained distinctly Barovian.
Yes, said Robin. Is that Mr. Brockbank?
Aye, that's right.
The quality of his silence was somehow threatening. Robin hastened to tell her fictitious story of the compensation that might await him if he were happy to meet her. When she had finished, he said nothing. Robin held her nerve, because Venetia Hall had the self-confidence not to rush to fill a silence, but the crackling of the slack line between them unnerved her.
And where did you find out about us, eh?
We came across your case notes while we were investigating.
Investigating what?
Why did she have such a feeling of menace? He couldn't be anywhere near her, but she scanned her surroundings all the same. The sunny, gracious street was deserted.
Investigating similar, non-combat-related injuries to other servicemen, she said,
wishing that her voice had not risen to such a high pitch. More silence. A car rolled towards her round the corner.
Damn it, Robin thought desperately, as she realized that the driver was the obsessive father she was supposed to be observing covertly.
He had looked her full in the face as she turned towards his car. She ducked her head and walked slowly away from the school.
So, what do I have to do then, eh?
Asked Noel Brockbank in her ear. Could we meet and have a chat about your history? Robin asked, her chest actually painful, so fast was her heart pounding.
I thought you'd read our history, he said,
and the hairs on the back of Robin's neck stood up.
A cunt called Cameron Strake gave us brain damage.
Yes, I saw that in your file, said Robin breathlessly. But it's important to take a statement so we can take a statement.
There was a pause that felt suddenly dangerous.
Sure you're no horny?
Robin Ellicott, Northerner, understood. Venetia Hall, Londoner, almost certainly would not. Horny was the Cumbrian word for policeman.
Not a what, I'm sorry, she said, doing her best to sound politely confused.
Mad Dad had parked outside his estranged wife's house. Any moment now, his sons would be leaving with their nanny for a playdate. If he accosted them, Robin needed to photograph the encounter. She was falling down on the paying job. She ought to be photographing Mad Dad's movements.
Police, said Brockbank aggressively.
Police, she said,
still striving for that tone of mingled disbelief and amusement.
Of course not.
You sure about that, are you?
The front door of Mad Dad's wife's house had opened. Robin saw the nanny's red hair and heard a car door open. She forced herself to sound offended and confused.
Yes, of course I am, Mr. Brockbank. If you're not interested...
Her hand was slightly damp on the phone. Then, taking her by surprise, he said,
All right, I'll meet you.
Excellent, said Robin, as the nanny led the two little boys onto the pavement. Whereabouts are you?
Shoreditch, said Brockbank.
Robin felt every nerve tingle. He was in London.
So where would be convenient to... What's that noise?
The nanny was screaming at Mad Dad, who was advancing on her and the boys. One of his sons began wailing.
Oh, I'm actually... It's just my day for picking up my son from school, said Robin loudly, over the background shrieks and shouts.
Silence again on the end of the line. Matter of fact, Venetia Hall would surely break it, but Robin found herself paralysed by what she tried to tell herself was an irrational fear. Then he spoke in a voice more menacing than Robin had ever heard, but more so because he half-crooned the words, so close to the receiver, that he seemed to be breathing into her ear.
"Do I know you, little girl?"
Robin tried to speak, but no sound came out. The line went dead. Chapter 33. Then the door was open and the wind appeared. Blue Oyster Cult, don't fear the Reaper. "I messed up with Brockbank," said Robin. "I'm really sorry. But I don't know how I messed up. Plus, I didn't dare take pictures of Mad Dad because I was too close." It was 9 o'clock on Friday morning, and Strike had arrived, not from the upstairs flat, but from the street, fully dressed and carrying his backpack again. Robin had heard him humming as he came up the stairs. He had stayed overnight at Ellen's. Robin had called him the previous evening to tell him about the Brockbank call, but Strike had not been at liberty to talk for long, and had promised that they would do so today.
"Never mind Mad Dad, we'll get him another day," said Strike, busy at the kettle. "And you did great with Brockbank. We know he's in Shoreditch. We know I'm on his mind, and we know he was suspicious that you might be police. So is that because he's been fiddling with kids up and down the country, or because he's recently hacked a teenager to death?"
Ever since Brockbank had spoken his last 6 words into her ear, Robin had felt slightly shaken. She and Matthew had barely talked to each other the previous evening, and having no outlet for a sudden feeling of vulnerability that she did not entirely understand, she had placed all her reliance on seeing Strike face to face and getting to discuss the meaning of those 6 ominous words.
"Do I know you, little girl?"
Today, she would have welcomed the serious, cautious Strike, who had taken the sending of the leg as a threat and warned her about staying out after dark. The man, now cheerfully making himself coffee and talking about child abuse and murder in a matter-of-fact tone, was bringing her no comfort. He could have no idea what Brockbank had sounded like, crooning inside her ear. "You know something else about Brockbank?" she said in a tight voice. "He's living with a little girl."
"He might not be living with her. We don't know where he left the phone."
"All right, then," said Robin, feeling even more tightly wound. "If you want to be pedantic, we know he's in close contact with the little girl." She turned away on the pretext of dealing with the mail she had scooped from the doormat on her arrival. The fact that he had arrived humming had irked her. Presumably his night with Ellen had been a welcome distraction, providing recreation and recuperation. Robin would have loved a respite from her hyper-vigilant days and evenings of frigid silence. The knowledge that she was being unreasonable did nothing to diminish her resentment. She scooped the dying roses in their dry plastic bag off the desk and pushed them headfirst into the bin.
"There is nothing we can do about that kid," said Strike.
A most enjoyable stab of anger shot through Robin.
"I won't worry about her then," she snapped.
Trying to extract a bill from an envelope, she accidentally ripped the whole thing in two.
"You think she's the only child at risk from an abuser? There'll be hundreds of them right now, just in London."
Robin, who had half expected him to soften now that she had revealed how angry she was, looked round. He was watching her, eyes slightly narrowed, with no air of sympathy.
"Keep worrying all you want, but it's wasted energy. There's nothing you or I can do about that kid. Brockbank's not on any registers. He hasn't got any convictions. We don't even know where she is or what she's..."
"Her name's Zahara," said Robin.
To her horror, her voice turned to a strangled squeal, her face flooded with colour, and tears started in her eyes. She turned away again, although not fast enough.
"Hey," said Strike kindly.
But Robin made a wild flapping gesture with her hand to stop him talking. She refused to break down. All that was holding her together was her ability to keep moving forwards, to keep doing the job.
"I'm fine," she said through clenched teeth. "I'm fine. Forget it."
She could not now confess how menacing she had found Brockbank's sign-off.
Little girl, he had called her. She was not a little girl. She was not broken or childlike, not any more. But Zahara, whoever she was.
She heard Strike leave for the landing, and a moment later, a large wad of toilet paper appeared in her swimming sights.
Thank you, she said thickly, taking it from Strike's hand and blowing her nose.
Several silent minutes passed, while Robin periodically dabbed at her eyes and blew her nose, avoiding looking at Strike, who was perversely remaining in her part of the office rather than heading for his own.
What?
Robin said at last, anger rising again at the fact that he was simply standing there watching her. He grinned. In spite of everything, she experienced a sudden desire to laugh.
Are you going to stand there all morning? She asked,
trying to sound cross.
No, said Strike, still grinning. I just wanted to show you something.
He ferreted in his backpack and pulled out a glossy property brochure.
Ellen's, he said. She went to see it yesterday. She's thinking of buying a flat there.
All desire to laugh fled. How exactly did Strike think that it would cheer Robin up to know that his girlfriend was thinking of buying a ludicrously expensive flat? Or was he about to announce, Robin's fragile mood began to collapse in on itself, that he and Ellen were moving in together? Like a film flickering rapidly before her eyes, she saw the upstairs flat empty, Strike living in luxury, herself in a tiny box room on the edge of London, whispering into her mobile so that her vegan landlady did not hear her. Strike laid the brochure on the desk in front of her. The cover showed a tall modern tower topped by a strange shield-like face in which wind turbines were set like three eyes. The legend read, Strata, SE1, London's most desirable residential property.
See? Said Strike.
His triumphant air was aggravating Robin beyond measure, not least because it seemed so unlike him to gloat about the prospect of borrowed luxury. But before she could respond, there was a knock on the glass door behind him.
Bloody hell, said Strike, in frank astonishment as he opened the door to Shanker,
who walked in, clicking his fingers and bringing with him the usual fug of cigarette smoke, cannabis, and body odour.
I was in the area,
said Shanker, unconsciously echoing Eric Wardle.
I found him for you, Bunsen.
Shanker dropped down onto the mock leather sofa, legs spread out in front of him, and took out a packet of Mayfairs.
You phone Whittaker? Asked Strike,
whose dominant emotion was astonishment that Shanker was awake so early in the morning.
Who else did you ask me to find?
Said Shanker, inhaling deeply on his cigarette and clearly enjoying the effect he was creating.
Catford Broadway, flat over a chip shop. The brass lives with him.
Strike held out his hand and shook Shanker's. Notwithstanding his gold tooth and the scar that twisted his upper lip, their visitor's grin was strangely boyish.
Want a coffee? Strike asked him.
Yeah, go on then,
said Shanker, who seemed disposed to bask in his triumph.
All right,
he added cheerfully to Robin.
Yes, thanks,
she said with a tight smile, returning to the unopened mail.
Talk about on a roll, Strike said quietly to Robin,
while the kettle boiled loudly and an oblivious Shanker smoked and checked texts on his phone.
That's all three of them in London. Whittaker in Catford, Brockbank in Shoreditch, and now we know Lang's in Elephant and Castle. Or he was 3 months ago.
She had agreed to it before doing a double take. How do we know Lang was in Elephant and Castle? Strike tapped the glossy brochure of the Strata on her desk.
What do you think I'm showing you that for?
Robin had no idea what he meant. She looked blankly at the brochure for several seconds before its significance struck her. Panels of silver punctuated the long jagged lines of darkened windows all down the rounded column. This was the background visible behind Lang as he stood on his concrete balcony.
Oh,
she said weakly. Strike wasn't moving in with Ellen. She did not know why she was blushing again. Her emotions seemed totally out of control. What on earth was wrong with her? She turned on her swivel chair to concentrate on the post yet again, hiding her face from both men.
"I don't know if I've got enough dosh on me to pay you, Shanker," Strike said, looking through his wallet. "I'll walk you down to a cash point."
"Fair enough, Bunsen," said Shanker, leaning over to Robin's bin to dispose of the ash trickling from his cigarette. "You need help with Whittaker, you know where I am."
"Yeah, cheers. I can probably handle it, though."
Robin reached for the last envelope in the post pile, which felt stiff and had an additional thickness at one corner, as though it contained a card with some kind of novelty attached. On the point of opening it, Robin noticed that it had been addressed to her, not Strike. She paused, uncertain, looking at it. Her name and the address of the office had been typed. The postmark was from central London, and the letter had been sent the previous day. Strike and Shanker's voices rose and fell, but she could not have said what they were saying. "It's nothing," she told herself. "You're overwrought. It couldn't happen again." Swallowing hard, she opened the envelope and gingerly removed the card. The image showed a Jack Vetriano painting of a blonde sitting in profile on a chair, which was draped in a dust sheet. The blonde was holding a teacup, and her elegant black-stockinged, stilettoed legs were crossed and raised on a footstool. There was nothing pinned to the front of the card. The object that she had felt through the card was taped inside it. Strike and Shanker were still talking. A whiff of decay caught her nostrils through the fug of Shanker's body odour.
"Oh, God,"
said Robin quietly, but neither man heard her. She flipped over the Vetriano print. A rotting toe was sellotaped to the inner corner of the card. Carefully printed in capital letters were the words, "She's as beautiful as a foot." She dropped it onto the desk and stood up. In slow motion, it seemed, she turned to Strike. He looked from her stricken face to the obscene object lying on the desk.
"Get away from it."
She obeyed, sick and trembling and wishing that Shanker was not there.
"What?"
Shanker kept saying.
"What? What is it? What?"
"Somebody sent me a severed toe," said Robin, in a collected voice that was not her own.
"You're fucking kidding me,"
said Shanker, moving forwards with eager interest. Strike physically restrained Shanker from picking up the card, which lay where it had fallen from Robin's hand. Strike recognized the phrase, "She's as beautiful as a foot." It was the title of another Blue Oyster Cult song.
"I'll call Wardle," Strike said.
But instead of taking out his mobile, he scribbled a 4-digit code on a post-it note and extracted his credit card from his wallet.
"Robin, go and get the rest of Shanker's money out for him, then come back here."
She took the note and the credit card, absurdly grateful for the prospect of fresh air.
"And Shanker," said Strike sharply, as the two of them reached the glass door, "you walk her back here, all right? Walk her back to the office."
"You got it, Bunsen,"
said Shanker, energized, as he always had been, by strangeness, by action, by the whiff of danger. Chapter 34. The lies don't count, the whispers do. Blue Oyster Cult, the vigil. Strike sat alone at the kitchen table in his attic flat that night. The chair was uncomfortable, and the knee of his amputated leg aching after several hours tailing Mad Dad, who had taken time out of work today to stalk his younger son on a trip to the Natural History Museum. The man owned his own company, or he would surely have been fired for the working hours he spent intimidating his children. Platinum, however, had gone unwatched and unphotographed. On learning that Robin's mother was due to visit that evening, Strike had insisted on Robin taking 3 days off, overriding all her objections, walking her to the tube, and insisting that she text him once safely back at her flat. Strike yearned for sleep. He felt too weary to get up and go to bed. He had been more disturbed by the second communication from the killer than he had been prepared to admit to his partner. Appalling though the arrival of the leg had been, he now acknowledged that he had nourished a vestige of hope that the addressing of the package to Robin had been a nasty embellishment, but an afterthought. The second communication with her, sly sideways wink at Strike notwithstanding, "She's as beautiful as a foot," had told him for certain that this man, whoever he was, had Robin in his sights. Even the name of the painting on the front of the card he had selected, the image of the solitary leggy blonde, was ominous. "In thoughts of you." Rage burgeoned in the motionless Strike, chasing away his tiredness. He remembered Robin's white face, and knew that he had witnessed the death of her faint hope that the sending of the leg had not been the random act of a madman. Even so, she had argued vociferously against taking time off, pointing out that their only two paying jobs frequently clashed. Strike would be unable to cover both properly on his own, and would consequently have to choose on a daily basis whether to follow Platinum or Mad Dad. He had been adamant. She should return to work only when her mother returned to Yorkshire. Their persecutor had now succeeded in reducing Strike's business to two clients. He had just endured a second incursion of police into his office, and was worried that the press would get wind of what had happened, even though Wardle had promised not to release news of the card and the toe. Wardle agreed with Strike that one of the killer's objectives was to focus press and police attention on the detective, and that it was playing into the killer's hands to alert the media. His mobile rang loudly in the small kitchen. Glancing at his watch, he saw that it was 10:20. He seized it, barely registering Wardle's name, as he raised it to his ear, because his mind had been on Robin. "Good news," Wardle told him. "Well, of a kind. He hasn't killed another woman. The toe's Kelsey's, off the other leg. Why, it's not want that, eh?" Strike, who was not in the mood for humour, replied brusquely. After Wardle had hung up, he continued to sit at his kitchen table, lost in thought, while the traffic growled past in Charing Cross Road below. Only the recollection that he had to get to Finchley the next morning to meet Kelsey's sister finally motivated him to begin the usual, onerous process of dealing with his prosthesis before bed. Strike's knowledge of London was, thanks to his mother's peripatetic habits, extensive and detailed. But there were gaps, and Finchley was one of them. All he knew about the area was that it had been Margaret Thatcher's constituency in the 1980s, while he, Leda and Lucy, had been moving between squats in places like Whitechapel and Brixton. Finchley would have been too far away from the centre to suit a family entirely reliant on public transport and takeaways. Too expensive for a woman who frequently ran out of coins for the electricity meter. The kind of place, as his sister Lucy might once have wistfully put it, where proper families lived. In marrying a quantity surveyor and producing three impeccably turned out sons, Lucy had fulfilled her childhood yearning for neatness, order, and security. Strike took the tube to West Finchley and endured a long walk to Summers Lane rather than find a taxi, because his finances were so bad. Sweating slightly in the mild weather, he moved through road after road of quiet detached houses, cursing the place for its leafy quiet and its lack of landmarks. Finally, 30 minutes after he had left the station, he found Kelsey Platt's house, smaller than many of its fellows, with a whitewashed exterior and a wrought iron gate. He rang the doorbell and immediately heard voices through the pane of frosted glass, like the one in his own office door.
"I think it's the detective, pet," said a Geordie voice. "You get it," said a woman's high-pitched voice.
A large red mass bloomed behind the glass, and the door opened onto the hall, which was mostly concealed by a burly, barefoot man in a scarlet toweling robe. He was bald, but his bushy grey beard, coupled with the scarlet robe, would have suggested Santa had he looked jolly. However, he was frantically mopping his face with a sleeve of his dressing gown. The eyes behind the glasses were swollen into bee-stung slits, and his ruddy cheeks were shining with tears.
"Sorry," he said gruffly, moving aside to let Strike in. "Working nights," he added, in explanation of his attire.
Strike sidled past. The man smelled strongly of Old Spice and camphor. Two middle-aged women were locked in a tight embrace at the foot of the stairs, one blonde, the other dark, both sobbing. They broke apart as Strike watched, wiping their faces.
"Sorry," gasped the dark-haired woman. "Cheryl's our neighbour. She's been in Megaloof. She's only just heard about Kelsey."
"Sorry," echoed red-eyed Cheryl. "I'll give you space, Hazel. Anything you need. Anything, Ray. Anything."
Cheryl squeezed past Strike.
"Sorry,"
and hugged Ray. They swayed together briefly, both big people, their bellies pressed together, arms stretched around each other's necks. Ray began sobbing again, his face in her broad shoulder.
"Come through,"
hiccuped Hazel, dabbing at her eyes as she led the way into the sitting room. She had the look of a Bruegel peasant, with her rounded cheeks, prominent chin, and wide nose. Eyebrows as thick and bushy as tiger moth caterpillars overhung her puffy eyes.
"It's been like this all week. People hearing and coming over and... sorry,"
she finished on a gasp. He had been apologized to half a dozen times in the space of 2 minutes. Other cultures would have been ashamed of an insufficient display of grief. Here in Quiet Finchley, they were ashamed to have him witness it.
"Nobody knows what to say,"
Hazel whispered, pressing away her tears as she gestured him to the sofa.
"It's not like she was hit by a car or was ill. They don't know what you say when someone's been..."
She hesitated, but balked at the word, and her sentence ended in a gargantuan sniff.
"I'm sorry," said Strike, taking his turn. "I know this is a terrible time for you."
The sitting room was immaculate and somehow unwelcoming, perhaps because of its chilly colour scheme. A three-piece suite covered in striped silvery grey cloth, white wallpaper with a thin grey stripe, cushions angled on their points, ornaments on the mantelpiece perfectly symmetrical. The dust-free television screen gleamed with reflected light from the window. Cheryl's misty form trotted past on the other side of the net curtains, wiping her eyes. Ray shuffled past the sitting room door on his bare feet, dabbing under his glasses with the end of his toweling robe belt, his shoulders stooped. As though she had read Strike's mind, Hazel explained.
"Ray broke his back trying to get a family out of a boarding house that caught fire. Wall gave way and his ladder fell. 3 stories.
"Christ," said Strike.
Hazel's lips and hands were trembling. Strike remembered what Wardle had said, that the police had mishandled Hazel. Suspicion, or rough questioning of her Ray, would have seemed unforgivable cruelty to her in this state of shock, an inexcusable exacerbation of their appalling ordeal. Strike knew a lot about the brutal intrusion of officialdom into private devastation. He had been on both sides of the fence.
"Anyone want a brew?"
Ray called huskily from what Strike assumed was the kitchen.
"Go to bed,"
Hazel called back, clutching a sodden ball of tissues.
"I can make 'em. Go to bed."
"You sure?"
"Get to bed. I'll wake you at 3.
Hazel wiped her whole face with a fresh tissue, as though it were a face cloth.
"He's not one for disability pay and all that, but nobody wants to give him a proper job,"
she told Strike quietly, as Ray shuffled, sniffing, back past the door.
"Not with his back and his age and his lungs not being the best. Cash in hand. Shift work."
Her voice trailed away, her mouth trembled.